Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
Listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Senator Elizabeth Warren's road to success has taken her to some interesting places, from a professorship at Harvard Law School to helping set up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And along the way, she served as chair of the TARP Congressional Oversight Panel and was a senior advisor to the National Bankruptcy Review Commission. She's also, of course, the senior senator from Massachusetts and an outspoken critic of the financial services industry. Her latest book, called A Fighting Chance, is now out in paperback with a new afterword. It's published by Picador, and I'm very pleased to welcome Senator Warren to our show today. Hello.
Hello. It's good to be here.
You write that over the course of your career, you've had five big fights, and that all of them were about attacks on the middle class. Why has that part of the economy been squeezed for so long?
You know, I think a big part of it has been about the decisions we've made as a country. You know, and it's got a long historical arc to it. We've been a boom and bust economy really pretty much forever. Started in 1792, the first big crash started right here in New York. And about every 15 years, you know, there'd be a boom and then there'd be a bust. And the problem was with the bust, it didn't just take down the speculators. You know, it took down shopkeepers and it took down farmers. And so when the big one hit, the crash in the 1930s, as a country, we said, you know, we can do better than that. We can actually make some policies in Washington that will change that. And by golly, that is exactly what we did.
After World War II, we went through an incredible boom. Why? And the middle class grew. What happened?
So you really start, like I said, late Depression and then on through the war years. And we did two things. First, we said there needs to be a cop on the beat, not just a cop on Main Street, but a cop on Wall Street. So we passed some basic financial regulation laws, right? We got the SEC, we got FDIC insurance, make it safe to put money in banks. Glass-Steagall, we said, if you want to go out there and gamble with money, that's fine, but you can't be a bank to do that. So first of all, we put these financial rules in place that kind of leveled the playing field, made it a lot safer, and it worked for about 50 years. The other thing that we did is that we invested heavily in our middle class, in opportunity. That's how I think of it. We invested, think about this, in education. A grateful nation said to returning GIs, we're going to give you the GI Bill. You can get an education. In DEA loans, we put money into state universities so that any kid, even a kid without money, was going to have a chance to go to school. Why? Because we said if we invest in education, our kids are going to have more opportunities. We invested in infrastructure. I know it sounds boring, but roads and bridges and power grids. And you know,
during the Eisenhower administration.
Oh, hugely. Okay, but we really did it for about 50 years, 1930s to about 1980. We invested in infrastructure on the theory that we didn't know what the next great business would be, but we were pretty darn sure they were going to need electricity. They were going to need roads and bridges to get their goods to market. And we invested in a third thing that made us remarkable. We invested in research, in scientific research and medical research. And we did this. We built this giant pipeline of ideas, this notion that our children would be able to make something that we couldn't even dream of, and their children would make something even better.
So is the reversal in all of these things, does that mean that we're returning to the Gilded Age?
Boy, you got that one on the table. You know, it really changes starting in about 1980.
Well, Bill Clinton, a president, was the president, I mean, a Democrat was the president when Glass-Steagall was revealed.
That's exactly right. No, that's what I mean. Starting about in 1980, deregulation became the watchword of the day, which really meant just fire the cops, not the cops on Main Street, the cops on Wall Street. And the vision of how to build a future was cut taxes for those at the top. And how are you going to make that work? Well, cut the investments in, you got it, education, infrastructure, research. And so that's what's happened since the 1980s. It's been less and less about building a future, opportunities for all of our kids, or as I put it in my book, a fighting chance for all of our kids, and more about making the country work for those who already have money and power.
A new study released by the Pew Charitable Trust this month found that since 2000, the number of middle-class households has shrunk in all 50 states. So is the middle class in an irreversible decline? Why are jobs being added at the top and at the bottom of the wage scale, but not at the middle?
Well, that's the real problem. And that is that the investments in building a middle, the investments in strengthening opportunity, not just for those at the top, but for all of our kids, that's where, since about 1980, this country has been underinvesting. It's been headed in the wrong direction. You ask me if it's an irreversible decline.
You've said the game is rigged.
The game is rigged.
You've been in Washington. You really see the game being rigged there?
Oh, it absolutely is rigged. Washington works. It works for those who have money and power. Washington works for those who can hire an army of lobbyists and lawyers. But for most American families, Washington isn't working at all.
You invoke the imagery of David versus Goliath a few times in this book, but you note that every once in a while, David gets his slingshot shoved down his throat sideways.
Yep.
And one of those losses was the nearly decade-long battle over bankruptcy laws. Mm-hmm. What happened there?
Well, so my work all along has been studying what's happening to America's middle class. Basically the 50 or so years in which we built a strong middle class. And then starting in the 80s, how decisions made in Washington began to undermine the middle class and big cracks start to appear. By the 1990s, we had hardworking, decent folks, people who did all the things we thought it took to get in the middle class. They went to college, they bought homes, they got married, they had kids, and yet were finding themselves flung over a financial cliff. Hundreds of thousands of people were filing for bankruptcy, people who were once solidly middle class. So the credit card companies looked at that and said, huh, we could increase our profitability, our bottom line, by, you know, maybe a percentage point or two, if we could just keep those folks out of bankruptcy, a bunch of them, and squeeze them a little harder, get them to pay some more interest payments because they were never going to be able to pay off the principal on the debt. Just squeeze them harder. So here we had these families for whom, think about it, bankruptcy is the best you can hope for, maybe scratching your way back to dead flat broke so that you'll have a chance to build something in the future. And the credit card companies were out there. They wanted to change the law to make it harder for those families to go into bankruptcy. That was my first time kind of in off the sidelines to get involved in a big policy fight. And you know what I saw? Credit card companies had it all. They had the lobbyists, they had the lawyers, they had the campaign contributions, they had it all. Folks who were about to file for bankruptcy or who had filed for bankruptcy, I mean, my God, they didn't have lobbyists, they didn't have lawyers. Most of them were so humiliated by filing for bankruptcy, by the need, they wouldn't have shown up at a political rally if they'd been invited. And that's how the game gets rigged. It gets rigged in favor of those who have money and power.
My guest is Elizabeth Warren, whose book, A Fighting Chance, was a New York Times bestseller when it was released in hardcover, now available in paperback with a new afterword. You talk about yourself as a defender of the middle class, and yet if you read a lot of the press, and not just the very conservative press, you are some kind of a left-wing crazy. Both Politico and The Hill ran stories in the last few days which have painted you as the liberal version of Senator Ted Cruz. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think they're just wrong.
They're making an equivalency statement there.
But look, I just want you to pay attention to the things I'm fighting for. The bill that I have on the floor now and that I've really pushed hard is to refinance student loan debt. The United States government is making billions of dollars in profits off the backs of our kids who are trying to get a college education. I think that's wrong, and I'm fighting hard on that. And that's something most of America agrees on. The government should not be making a profit. I believe in equal pay for equal work, something most of America agrees with. I believe that we should strengthen Social Security and expand our coverage in Social Security. And that's something most Americans agree with. You know, I feel like what I'm doing is I'm out here fighting to give a voice to America's middle class, to America's working families, to everybody who believes that we can together help create some opportunities, not just for some of our kids, but for all of our kids.
Now, student loan debt can't be cleared in bankruptcy.
No.
How did that come up?
Oh, God. Part of this happened in exactly that bankruptcy war that I was just talking about. When the banks joined in, along with the credit card companies, the banks that had student loan debt, and they got it fixed. Federal student loan debt, by this point, was already what's called non-dischargeable. You can't get rid of it in bankruptcy. And they coasted right in and said, oh, let's make sure that private student loan debt, producing a profit for the big banks, can't be discharged either. It's really appalling.
Student loan debt is well over $1 trillion.
Yep.
Is that a drag on the economy?
Oh, it absolutely is a drag on the economy.
Well, you would think that people would want to change it for that reason alone.
No kidding. There have been reports from the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the Treasury Department, and the Fed, all three saying that this giant overhang of student loan debt, it's now about $1.3 trillion. It affects 40 million Americans. Is dragging down our economy. It's causing young people not to buy cars, not to buy homes, not to start small businesses. They're not able to get their feet under them and start their financial lives because they're being dragged down by student loan debt. The government should not be making a profit off student loans, not at the expense of our students.
On another front, you've been very critical of the revolving door between Washington and Wall Street. But is there much that can be done to stop former members of Congress from going to work for a major bank or for former heads of banks being appointed to governmental positions?
Well, you know, for openers, we can at least call it out and say no. You know, you can start by just saying, as a country, we think that's wrong. We don't think that's the right way to go. But I actually think that we could change some of the rules around this. We could at least slow down the revolving door instead of saying, hey, you know, that's just how it is, and keep it well greased so it moves as fast as possible. To me, this is a fight worth having because it raises that fundamental question. Who do you work for? Do you think you just work for the biggest financial institutions in this country, or do you work for the American people?
When people leave companies, sometimes they have to sign a non-compete agreement, at least for years. Some years, could we do the same thing?
We could, but it's going to take changing the laws. It's changing the laws and changing the culture. It's reminding people our government is supposed to work for us.
Well, but the people who would have to change the laws are the people who benefit from the laws the way they are, so they're not likely to change it.
You know, but this is how it feels to be an outsider. You know, I've been an outsider all my life, and I come to this work really late. You know, I've spent my life fighting for America's middle class, working on it. And so the way I see this is you just got to pick these fights. You can't start by saying we're going to lose it. You start by saying here's something that's wrong and here's a way to fix it.
So even though you're a member of a major party, you still feel, and you're a senator, you still feel like you're an outsider?
I'll always be an outsider.
According to the Gallup poll, or at least one Gallup poll, trust in American institutions, with the exception of the military, is at all-time lows. Congress and big business are, in fact, near the bottom. What makes them so unpopular, and why hasn't that led them to change course? When you speak to people in Congress, and they joke about the fact that atheists score better than people in Congress, how do they explain themselves?
Look, the game is rigged. And the American people get that. The reason Congress has a low, low approval rating, and many of the largest corporations do as well, is because people understand that this is a government that's not working for them. This is a set of rules that's not working for them. What I believe about this is that it's time to fight back. And here's the best part. I actually don't want to just kind of do the general, we should all fight back. I really want to make a point around this. Back during the financial crisis, right in the middle of the crisis, it was time to rewrite the financial rules, and everybody in Washington recognized. So it's that moment. The
Didn't
door
we get
opens.
Dodd-Frank?
And that's what we get is Dodd-Frank. But I want to tell you a little subpart of that. So I'd been studying what happened with mortgages and credit cards. I had watched these huge financial institutions just cheat people, sell mortgages that they knew were going to cost them their homes in another couple of years. And so I believe that what we needed to do is we needed a new agency. There was a lot of federal law out there, but it was scattered among seven different agencies. It wasn't a first priority for any of them. So I said, I tell you what, gather up all those laws, put them with a new agency, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, then give it the power to be a real watchdog and then hold it responsible. And that way we can begin to level the playing field. Big banks can't make all their profits by just painting a bullseye on the backsides of American families and shooting at will. So I had this idea for this agency, and I went around Washington. My first notion was I'll go talk to people about this, knock on doors. I don't really know how to do this. And people said two things to me that were just stunning. The first one was, huh, that's a good idea. You could actually make a difference with something like this. And then the second thing was, don't do it, because you will never get it passed. You won't get it passed because the big banks will hate it, which turned out to be true. They spent about $1 million a day lobbying against it and other
financial
reforms.
And now they're threatening to withhold support to Democrats.
Oh, absolutely. But here was the key. I said, I heard this when people said, don't do it because you can't ever get it passed. Washington will never pass it. The banks have too much power here. And I heard that as, try harder. Get out there and just punch them harder. And so I began to just talk to a lot more people, tried to get people organized, conference calls, groups. Ultimately, we started bringing in groups. The AFL-CIO, God bless him, said, we're in. This affects working people. AARP said, we're in. This affects retired people. NAACP said, we're in. Consumers Union said, we're in. La Raza said, we're in. And ultimately, when it came right down to it, this is a story I tell how it worked in the book. When it came right down to it, we forced a public vote on the consumer agency. And when it was a public vote, we got that agency passed into law. And just here's a little side piece. All the ways we talk about how government's not working, that little agency has been up and running for about 4 years now. And it has already forced the biggest financial institutions in this country to return about $5 billion to people they cheated. And it's caused a lot of financial institutions just not to head down paths where they might cheat people. That's government that works. And why does it work? Why did it happen? Because enough people got involved. There was enough push from people saying, we're sick of this. We're not going to put up with this anymore.
How effective has that agency been?
It has been. Are you kidding? $5 billion? I'll tell you how effective it's been. It's been effective enough that the big banks and their friends in Washington are trying to find a way to shorten its leash. They're trying to put it on what's called appropriations so they can cut its funding so that the watchdog can be turned into a lapdog. It's effective enough that people are who want to keep the status quo as they liked it, the one where the banks get to do whatever they want, are fighting back against that agency. And you know what? We're not going to give up on this.
My guest is Elizabeth Warren, who has written A Fighting Chance. It was a New York Times bestseller when it was released as a hardcover book, now available in paperback from Picador. You've been asked repeatedly if you're running for president despite your repeated denials. Why do you think they keep on doing that?
You know, I'm not running for president.
Some people have said that actually, if they thought you were, you'd be less effective. It would look like you're saying these things because you're running rather than simply because you believe in them.
I think that this is really about a set of issues. I don't think this is about me. I think this is about a core set of issues. I think this is about a fight that's going on about the direction that our country will go. And it's really a different vision. The Republicans have a vision that say it's fundamentally trickle-down economics. We'll cut taxes for those at the top. We'll fire the cops on Wall Street. And somehow that combination is going to build a future for everybody else. Less investment in education, less investment in infrastructure, less investment in research. What I believe and what folks on my side say is no. We believe that you really do need an effective cop on Wall Street and on Main Street. And we believe that we all pitch in something to help build a future, not just for some of our kids, but for all of our kids. And that's what fundamentally this choice is about.
It almost seems certain that Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton will announce their candidacies for president any day now. People are talking about a dynastic aspect to American politics.
You know, I want to see the issues. I want to see what issues we're going to talk about. I want to know who's going to step up and say, we've got to reduce the interest rate on student loans. Who's going to say it's time for equal pay for equal work? Who's going to say it's time to expand Social Security benefits? Who's going to be out there to hold Wall Street accountable? That's what really matters.
Well, it's likely that New York Senator Chuck Schumer will replace Harry Reid as the Democratic leader in the Senate. Last week, CNN ran an article saying that Wall Street is welcoming the prospect of Schumer becoming Senate Minority Leader. Do you think he is too close to the financial and banking industries to do the things you're talking about?
I worry about everybody being too close to Wall Street. I worry about this everywhere in Washington. But I will say this about Chuck Schumer. When it came time to fight for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, long before it was popular, Chuck Schumer was in on it, and Chuck Schumer was strong on it.
Fox Business reported last week that Citibank currently has researchers monitoring comments and speeches that you've made. How do you feel about that?
Hey, there's an audience, huh?
Well, FDR once said he welcomed the hatred of the banks.
You know, I find this stunning that these are the same institutions. Let's just be clear, because this is in a really short period of time, that loaded up on risks, that crashed the economy, that got bailed out by the U.S. taxpayer, that then spent literally millions and millions of dollars trying to lobby against any kind of effective financial reforms, that have now expanded the size of their financial institutions and loaded up on new kinds of risks, and they want to complain because they don't like what I have to say about them?
In the book, you describe a meeting you had with JPMorgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon shortly after you were elected, which got heated fairly quickly.
It did.
You said you thought his bank was, quote, breaking the law, and then he replied, so hit me with a fine. We can afford it.
Yeah.
And hasn't that been the policy of the Obama administration?
Look, this has been a problem in government now, basically since about the 1980s, and that is, you know, it's been a deregulatory environment, serve the banks rather than provide some kind of oversight and accountability. I want to be clear. There are just two things I want from the biggest financial institutions. I don't want it so they can cheat families on credit cards or mortgages or checking accounts or anything else, not for $10 and not for $200,000. I don't want that. And that's what the consumer agency is about. And the second is I don't want them to be able to bring down our economy again. And that's what the whole too big to fail is about. Do understand, these big financial institutions that we bailed out, these financial institutions that we were told by the Secretary of the Treasury back in 2008 are too big to fail, are roughly about a third bigger now than they were back then. And they're taking on new kinds of risks. They're out there trading in aluminum futures. You know, this is a world in which the largest financial institutions don't want to have any accountability. They don't want somebody who says, wait a minute, you don't get to use bank-insured deposits to get out there and take risks and build your business. The American taxpayer is going to be on the hook. We've got to support the bank part of this. We should separate out your risk-taking and move it somewhere else. It used to be called Glass-Steagall. Glass-Steagall got repealed. I just want to say on this, I have a bill to separate them again. And my break up the banks. You know who my co-sponsor is on this new Glass-Steagall bill? It's John McCain. John McCain and then Angus King and Maria Cantwell of Washington, Angus King of Maine, where we have said, no, enough of this. If a big financial institution wants to get out there and take risks, then you can't be a bank at the same time. Banking should be boring.
When a bank like HSBC gets caught violating sanctions on Iran and laundering money for Mexican drug cartels, and no one is held criminally responsible. Right. What does that say about our justice system?
You know, this is the reminder how much the game is rigged. HSBC violated the law over and over and over, laundering drug money. Let's draw a line under that. They laundered drug money. They got caught, told not to do it, and went right back and did it again and again. And yet, nobody, they end up paying a fine, and their executives get raises. And yet, how many kids across this country got arrested at the same time for having a little marijuana? You know, you just want to look at this and say, talk about the game is rigged. The big guys don't have to play by the same set of rules as everyone else. And that's what's got to change. We have got to run this country again for the families, for people, not just for the biggest financial institutions.
This month, the FDIC noted that three foreign-owned banks, HSBC again, mm-hmm. BNP Paribas, and Royal Bank of Scotland have inadequate living wills. Mm-hmm. Are you confident that most banks could wind down operations if they got in trouble?
I'm not only not confident. I want to be clear. The FDIC and the Fed issued a report last summer that said 11 of the largest financial institutions in this country are now so big and so dangerous that if they started to stumble, that either they'd have to be bailed out by the American taxpayer again, or they would threaten to bring down the entire economy. That's where we stand today, while the biggest financial institutions are saying, leave me alone, we don't want any oversight.
So how do you break up the banks?
Well, one of them is just separate ordinary banking, what you and I think of.
What we used to have in the old days?
Yeah, exactly right. Savings accounts and checking accounts, you know, that's standard banking. We want to have that. We want to have insured accounts, but that should be boring banking. Anyone who wants to take the kinds of risks they want to get out and trade in whatever commodities or stocks they want to trade in, then they've got to be separate from a bank.
So we'd have six banks of America instead of one?
You know, at least let's break it into the two parts, the part that's boring banking and the part that takes the risk. They should not be allowed, these big banks should not be allowed to take risks with your grandma's savings account.
So do you support changing our marijuana laws?
You know, I think it's something we have to look at. But the point is, we need a level playing field. It cannot be the case that executives from the biggest financial institutions in the country launder drug money and not one single person even gets arrested. And I want to be clear. I want to make sure everybody knows
this. We do
collect
a lot of fines.
We collect some fines.
But that's the cost of doing
business. But this goes back to Jamie Dimon's point. When Jamie Dimon said, so hit me with a fine, we can afford it. He's saying, in effect, this is just a cost of doing business. I'll make the decision whether to abide by the law or to break it, make the profits, and pay what fine you guys impose on me.
Weren't these all issues that Occupy Wall Street brought up? Why do you think that became such a big story and then has totally disappeared?
You know, I don't know. You probably need somebody who's better at analyzing the shift over time. But I'll tell you this. We need to fight for specific things. That's what I really believe. I have a Glass-Steagall bill on the table. I want the largest financial institutions separated at least into two parts. I have a student loan refinancing bill on the table. I have a bill on the table to put more money into research for the National Institutes of Health. I'm supporting the Equal Pay for Equal Work bill. I believe that nobody should work full-time and still live in poverty, and that means raising the minimum wage. I just want to be clear. There are a half dozen changes we could make in this country that would help build a floor, that would help open opportunities, that would help strengthen our middle class again. And here's the key thing I want you to remember. Most of America agrees with all of that. This isn't some, off at the left or off at the right. No, this is the heart of America. This is what it's all about. This is how we build a future, not just for some of our kids, but for all of our kids. It's about, like I call it in the book, a fighting chance.
Just one more thing before you go. A number of people are up for minority leader. Patty Murray, is it? Who's Well, Dick Durbin is one. I can't remember the name. One woman is up there as well, and of course Chuck Schumer. Are you supporting one or any of the others?
You know, I think it's likely to be Chuck who is going to be the minority leader. But all of the whole leadership team, that's going to work out. We've got a year and a half. Harry Reid has given plenty of time for Democrats to work on this. I tell you the part I stay focused on. I stay focused on the changes we can make day by day. That's what we need to do.
Do you have other Democrats who are angry with you because of some of the positions you've taken?
Gee, not so far as I know.
No, but
look, just Thursday night, you know, we had that big Votorama and we were all there until 4 in the morning. I just want to point out, we are making changes. This one, it doesn't bind anybody yet, but we're making clear the difference between our side and their side. The student loan bill, we had every single Democrat vote to refinance it. Every single Republican voted against it. Social Security, making sure that it's going to be stable and that we expand Social Security. We had the Democrats supporting it, all but a couple, and all the Republicans against it. Equal pay for equal work. Those are divisions between the parties in Washington, not between people, not between people who are Democrats and Republicans across this country, but the parties in Washington. That's what democracy is supposed to be about. We get our ideas out there. The other side gets their ideas out there, and the American people pick.
But do you think that we won't really see any real progress until the same party controls the House and has over 60 votes in the Senate?
You know, I think we won't see any real progress until people get more actively engaged. We didn't get that Consumer Financial Protection Bureau because of a particular party. We got it because enough people around this country pushed back, and some of them through AARP and AFL-CIO, and some of them just by writing in, calling in, staying online, and staying connected. We got that agency because people fought for it. And now that agency is making a difference in the lives of those people.
Elizabeth Warren's book, A Fighting Chance, has just been published in a paperback edition with a new afterword by Picador. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Oh, thanks for having me here. This is a good conversation.
When he's mentoring on Project Runway, Tim Gunn dispenses discerning critiques, a sharp sense of style, and utters signature catchphrases like, make it work. In his new book, The Natty Professor, a masterclass on mentoring, motivation, and making it work, he reveals that all three of those things, frankness, appearance, and encouragement, are part of a teaching philosophy he's developed over the course of 30 years. Long before there was reality television, he was a classroom educator and ultimately chair of the Parsons Fashion Design Program. His book, which also offers advice for teachers and dishes about his life in fashion and TV, is published by Gallery Books, written with the help of Ada Calhoun. I'm very pleased that it brings Tim Gunn back to our show today. Hello.
Leonard, it's wonderful to be with you again, and thank you for that lovely introduction.
You say that you would like for this book to start a national conversation about teaching. What do you see as the main problems in today's education, and are you talking about teaching being the same, whether it's fashion, math, science, or language?
I am talking about it being the same. I believe that it's the threshold for teaching doesn't matter according to discipline. Any discipline qualifies. But the reason I really want to join in on this national conversation is because I feel we undervalue individuals and we teach to too low a common denominator, and I believe in raising the bar and raising the bar above where we think students should be. Because in my experience, if you raise that bar above them, they're going to reach for it and possibly attain it. And if the bar is where their current capacity is or worse, lower than that, that's as far as they're going to go.
But some kids are going to respond and others are just some kids are just not interested in going to school. So
well, you know,
how do you motivate the kids who need something else to get them to take education seriously?
Well, I maintain that the two most difficult constituencies to teach are those who are, as you're describing, at the very bottom and unmotivated. That is a huge responsibility that the teacher has. And on the other end of the spectrum, it's those who are very gifted, who in fact take in this content and methodology very easily. And if you can strive to reach both constituencies in the same class, everyone in between comes up as well.
Education in America is largely affected by politics these days.
Which I think is disgraceful.
What's the role of the teacher within the grand scheme of national and state decided curriculum, testing policies, teacher testing, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I will say this. I believe strongly in teacher evaluations. I believe it's best done by a jury of peers who really understand what goes into being a teacher and all of the myriad complexities of that. I have to say also that I believe that core competencies are really necessary for our young people. Otherwise, how do we evaluate how well they're doing and how well they're assimilating this content?
So you would have no problems with the Regents exams in your state?
No, like not that. At all. As a matter of fact, did you read recently that there is talk about, in some states, about removing bar examinations for law graduates? And I thought, I don't want to go to a lawyer who hasn't been certified.
Weren't you able to see things in certain Project Runway contestants that the judges couldn't see? Isn't there also room for nuance?
Oh, absolutely.
And testing eliminates nuance.
For example, I
did very poorly on tests, but I was always active in the class. And I always thought that that my participation should count for something. Well, it did with a few teachers, but an awful lot of teachers simply marked by the way you did in the midterm and the final.
Well, I think that's a deficiency and an inadequacy on the part of the teacher, because I agree with you.
I did too.
There are students who don't test well, but in fact are exceptional, curious learners.
You have organized your book around an acronym, which spells out TEACH. What does it stand for?
TEACH stands for truth-telling, empathy, asking, cheerleading, and hoping for the best, which I love in particular.
And you come from a family of teachers. Is that what you expected to be doing from an early age?
Well, no. My mother started the library at the CIA in its early days, and my father was a career FBI agent. But my niece is a teacher, and my sister and brother-in-law have been in education as well. So, yes, that part of the family certainly.
So did you have to have this book redacted?
No, fortunately.
You changed schools a lot as a child.
I hated school. I actively hated it. I loved learning, but I hated the social aspects.
And you say you had some pretty cruel teachers. Do you think that's typical?
Yes.
Were they picking on you?
Well, they were trying. One in particular in the sixth grade was trying to rid me of my shyness, and he felt that by ordering me to throw a chalkboard eraser across the room, he would help me. And instead, I fled the room in a state of panic.
And you still remember his name, Mr. Allison?
I remember his name well.
Do you think so those things stay with you all your life?
They do. I think you remember the teachers who had a very positive impact and a very negative one, and you tend to forget everyone in the middle.
Well, a lot of people, when they're parenting, they have two ways of approaching it. One is to do exactly what their parents did, and the other is to do exactly the opposite of what
Yes.
their parents did. So I'm assuming that as a teacher, you have decided to do the opposite of what some of these teachers did.
And to emulate those teachers who were so profoundly wonderful and who really tapped into my inner resources and allowed me to ascend.
Well, you say your first good experience with teachers was in art school.
Yes.
Because our teachers were more interested in finding out what you wanted to do.
That was part of it. But another part, and it's a part that's helped me through my whole life, was that art teachers are strict disciplinarians. They only want the highest quality of work out of you.
But also, I think art students, most of them anyway, set their own standards, and they usually set pretty high standards for themselves, and that must help a teacher.
Well, indeed it does, and it also helps when the teacher raises that bar, as I said earlier, beyond your grasp, so to speak, and you're able to continue to rise, to ascend.
You write about how you had a soap carving assignment in elementary school. Most of the kids carved animals, as I probably would have. You made the governor's palace from Colonial Williamsburg.
I did. I was very proud of it.
Have you seen that? Has that lasted? Or did you wash with it at some point?
I don't know what happened to it, to be honest. But I loved architecture, and I was a Lego fanatic. And for me, it was the most natural thing in the world to do with a bar of ivory soap.
Now, you come across as a very disciplined person. Is that something that you came to by yourself?
It came from my art student days. I learned how to calibrate my time well. I learned how to calibrate ambitions and how to manage time. And discipline is, or self-discipline, I think it's very essential in all of us.
You write in the book that it's a rare day that you don't make your own bed, that you keep the items in your closet to a minimum because you're a hoarder at heart.
I think I am.
So how do you keep yourself? What do you do with the stuff that you'd like to keep that you're not keeping?
I have to be in the right state of mind. And there are certain days when that state of mind actually calls to me and says, okay, today you can do it.
Do you still make art?
No, I don't.
But you think along those lines. You talk about how much you love the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
I'm crazy about it, yes.
My guest is Tim Gunn, who has written something of a memoir called The Natty Professor, written with the help of Ada Calhoun, subtitled A Masterclass on Mentoring, Motivating, and Making It Work. You say that when you started out as a young design teacher, you had such bad stage fright that you once threw up in the parking lot before class?
Every morning for a whole week.
Now, why were you so nervous? Just like stage fright?
Yeah, stage fright and feeling, to be perfectly honest, completely inadequate, almost feeling like a fraud, thinking, am I really capable of doing this?
So what got you past that?
Drive and determination and a great mentor.
So somebody helped you, said what kind of advice
I'll see how you respond to or what category you would put this advice in. It was a teacher who was very important to me when I was studying. Her name is Rona Slade, and she's the one who hired me for this position. And I went to her at the end of this week of turmoil and despair, and I was hoping she would just say to me, okay, go away, go home, I'll find someone to replace you. And I sat with her and explained what was going on with me, and she said, well, I trust that this will either kill you or cure you, and I'm counting on the latter. Good day.
And that was it.
That was it. So I thought I didn't want to disappoint her, so that was part of my motivation.
And did a light bulb go off in your head?
Eventually. But with each successive day, it did become easier, but I want to say something else, Leonard. I crossed a line where I discovered that I can't be and don't want to be the answer man. I was so concerned with having an encyclopedic knowledge that any question that was asked of me by any student, I would have an immediate answer for. And I thought, that's wrong-minded. Don't do that.
As you tell the story, by the time you became an administrator at Parsons, you'd become a very different person. Some of the decisions you made were rather unpopular, leading to petitions and protests and T-shirts with your face on them.
And I wish I had one.
Yeah, well, where can you find them?
I don't know. Maybe on eBay.
Did you ever question your decisions, the ones that led to that kind of angry response?
To be perfectly honest, and I hope this doesn't sound arrogant, no. I knew in advance that my actions were going to be controversial, but I believed in what needed to happen, and it was for the greater good.
What were some of the things that bothered people?
Well, I took what was arguably the most famous program at Parsons, the Department of Fashion Design, and turned it upside down. It was a dinosaur of a program. The curriculum hadn't changed in more than 50 years, There was no technology. There was no fashion history. There was no design dialogue. I said to the dean,
they still had dresses with bustles.
Just about. I mean, honestly, just about. I said to the dean, this is a dressmaking school. This is not a design department. So we needed to make a lot of change, and it ruffled a lot of feathers.
What about the way people dress when they come to school? Can you tell whether they're going to be good or bad at designing for others?
I'd like to say that you can, but you can't. You can't. In fact, I had to have a session with the fashion faculty about how they were dressing. I mean, I had a faculty member wearing flannel pajamas with soccer balls on them. But this is not appropriate. Right.
There's a lot in the book about your time on Under the Gun. What was it like for you transforming from your role as a mentor on Project Runway to mentoring mentors on that show?
To be honest, it was really difficult. It was not an easy transition by any means. And what was especially difficult was the mentors I was mentoring were between me, literally and metaphorically, between me and the designers on the show. So I didn't have ease of access to those designers if I had an opinion about what they were doing. And it took a lot of self-discipline to keep from running into that workroom saying, do this.
Well, did you see yourself in the struggling mentors, Mondo, Anya, Nick?
Did I see myself?
Yeah, your early throwing up days.
I did see a bit of that, yes.
Let's talk about empathy and hoping for the best in your students, two of the elements of the teach philosophy. Is that something a teacher can learn? Isn't that something you have to have in your personality?
Well, in the context of teach and empathy, it's specifically, about how to present words and a tone to another individual about something that you want them to listen to. So I rehearse it in my own head. How would I respond to this if someone were to say it to me like this? And then I amended accordingly. And it came from a lot of bad experiences where I would critique someone and they go screaming out of the room, crying and shouting.
You also do Dish here a bit. And I'm sure some people will not be 100% happy with this book. Someone like Padma Lakshmi, for example.
you did a makeover
show called Tim Gunn's Guide to Style. And you tell a story about asking her to come help one of your mentees get over the fear of a scar, since she also has a very visible scar on her arm from a childhood accident.
She does. And, you know, I just have to say this. And Padma has been enormously successful and I'm sure has achieved much. But that was such a profoundly disappointing moment because I needed her, and this woman needed her, and she failed.
Well, some people can empathize with others, see themselves in the other person's problem, and others feel, well, I did this by myself. I came through it by dint of my strength, or in her case, probably my good looks, and I'm not sure I can help anybody else or I should help anybody else. This is part of the big political debate in America, isn't
well,
it?
It is. And I have to say, I learned something very interesting recently from a psychologist. There are two groups of people who cannot, by definition, possess empathy. They are narcissists and sociopaths.
And I'm not going to ask you with how many narcissists and sociopaths have you had to deal with in the fashion world?
And entertainment, too.
Yes.
This studio would have to explode to contain all of them.
You have to have a big ego to run a fashion house, for example.
Oh, you have to. So, but I think you can have a big ego and not be and be neither a narcissist nor a sociopath.
You're right that many teachers see themselves so much in their students that the student's successes and failures become wrapped up in a teacher's ego. What kind of advice would you give a teacher who's struggling with that?
Well, it's critically important to separate yourself from what it is that your students do. I'm always telling the Project Runway designers, we're having this conversation now about your work, but you, the designer, you have to own responsibility for your decisions.
Do you miss teaching?
Sure. Though I have to say, in my own way, I'm sure this is the case with you as well. I feel every day that I'm a student and I'm a teacher.
Tim Gunn is best known as the co-host of the 12-time Emmy Award-nominated reality show Project Runway. He's also hosted his own reality competition show, Under the Gun, and the makeover series Tim Gunn's Guide to Style. His latest book, his follow-up to his bestseller Gunn's Golden Rules and Tim Gunn's Fashion Bible, is Tim Gunn, The Natty Professor, a masterclass on mentoring, motivating, and making it work, written with the help of Ada Calhoun, published by Gallery Books. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thank you, Leonard. I'm always thrilled to be here with you. Thank you.
There were raves for the hit revival of David Harris' Skylight in London last summer. The Mail on Sunday called it a scorching production, a brilliant play with about changing and clashing values and the true cost of love. And now the good news is that it has come to Broadway with its cast intact. Carey Mulligan stars as the schoolteacher Kira Hollis, who receives an unexpected visit from Tom Sargent, a successful restaurateur who she hasn't seen for 3 years. Bill Nye plays the pent-up Tom, and I'm thrilled to have all three of these talented people with me here today, David Hare, Carey Mulligan, and Bill Nye.
Good
Hello.
Morning. Hey, how are you?
David, this is a play of yours that hasn't been seen for close to 20 years. What made you want to revive it now?
Well, I've always said that the original casts were Michael Gambon and Leah Williams, and then in production that followed very quickly in the West End, Bill Nye played with Stella Gonet. And for years, people have tried to revive this play, and I've always said, sorry, you can't do it until we get a cast as good as the original, because the memory of those first productions is so strong.
And then didn't you ask Bill Nye to do it again?
Not quite, Bill, would you say?
This time around, I don't know what quite remember the process. No,
well, I've read that you said no.
Oh, in the originally, yes, yeah. Yes. No, originally, I saw Michael Gambon and Leah Williams in Skylight with Daniel Betts, and it overwhelmed me. I was completely bowled over by it. It was one of, if not the greatest time I ever had in a theatre, and I wrote to everybody, and I rang David, the author, and congratulated him on his play Skylark. And which got me off to a great start. He said, don't worry, everybody does that. Even now in New York, when people say, you're in a play, what's it called? I point at the ceiling when I say the word. So I say skylight, pointing at the ceiling.
Well, there are skylarks up there, too.
To protect them from making the same mistake. But and then, because I was so impressed by it, when I was then offered the revival, I did invent it, as I had a habit of doing so in those days, as something out of my range, thinking that I couldn't possibly follow Sir Michael.
Is that?
And David then called me personally, at which point I said, yes, 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 okay, okay, okay.
Because a typical question to ask actors is, you know, you've seen the original production with this great actor, and that character, he made that character his own, and then you had to follow it. And actors will always say the same thing. Well, I found my own way of dealing with that character. But you were intimidated by Michael Gambon?
I mean,
he's a pretty great actor.
He's a wonderful actor who is, you know, is a genius, in my view. And therefore, it was daunting. And I did spend the first couple of days of rehearsal very lonely and frightened, because I couldn't forgive myself for not being Michael Gambon.
Then
I realized I didn't have to be Michael Gambon.
Wasn't Skylight or Skylark or whatever it's called set in the wake of Thatcher's reign? Did that have any impact on your writing of it originally, David?
Yeah, it did, in the sense that I had sort of educators, nurses, police, priests had become my heroes and heroines in a whole series of plays. You know, I felt that the government was ideological. It had certain theories about what was happening in society. And there were these people whose job I felt was to bandage the wounds. And I'd written about a lot of them, and they had become my heroes. And so Kira, who has left private enterprise in order to go and work in the toughest school in the East End, which a certain number of people were doing in the 1990s, was someone that I admired and wanted to defend in the course of the play.
Although this is at its heart a romantic play, it's also a lot about money. And one of the newer feeling themes involves Tom's sense of being persecuted because he's rich, Were people saying that in the 90s as well?
It's quite extraordinary. There's a speech that Carey Mulligan has in the second act where she says that the rich no longer do something called making money. They do something much nicer called the creation of wealth, and that we're all meant to be very, very nice to them because they're doing something on behalf of society by putting money in their pockets. And how ridiculous is it? Now, everyone asks me, oh, you must have written this speech in the last few years. Not at all. I wrote that speech in 1994.
Well, when you had to, when you first looked at that speech, Carrie, did you think, oh, gee, I could have said this today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I was 14 when David wrote the play. So, I mean, I wasn't thinking massively about it then, I don't suppose, and if I had even read the play. But, yeah, I think, it's funny though, particularly in New York, that play seems to resonate in a way, but in London, it definitely did, but out here, even more so, I think.
You can tell that from the way the audience responds?
Well, the audience here are more vocal in general, but particularly to that speech, there seems to be a
Well, actually, the night I saw the play, the audience burst into applause as though you were a politician who had made some speech.
Yes, it was fun.
What did you do? This is the third time that you're playing this role now, Bill, because you did it that first time, and then in London and here. Now, is it different coming here? And I asked the both of you this. Is it different coming here than after you've done it on the West End? Is the theater, the Golden, similar to the theater you worked in London?
Yeah, it's not dissimilar. It's a beautiful theater, and it's a nice size, and it feels very good in there, as it did at the Wyndham's in London. As Kerry says, the audiences, I think, they kind of shade it in terms of how vocal they are. And they occasionally, which is unusual, which is unexpected for an English artist, they occasionally clap before you've done anything.
Yes. When you come on the stage,
the
audience applauds.
I remember the first time, the only other time I've worked on Broadway, in David's play, The Vertical Hour, some years ago, and the first time I came on in a preview, they clapped, and I think I even looked behind me to see if something had happened, because I thought, I haven't done anything yet.
Carrie, how long a break did you have between the British and American productions?
6 months.
So in those 6 months, did you think about this character at all?
Not massively. No, I mean, I just sort of took six. Before we did Skylight in London, I'd worked quite intensely for about a year, and then I went straight into this without a break. So I did the run in London quite exhausted. So I was looking forward to doing the run in New York feeling not tired, which is
Have your thoughts about Kira changed over time?
I mean, I think
sometimes when you take a break, you come back to a character, you say, oh, gee, I never realized this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the thing about theatre, when you're lucky enough to do a transfer like this, is that you've had that much more time in life to think about things. And, you know, if you could do that in film, the curse of film is that every time you watch something, you think, oh, that was a year ago, and now with a year's more life behind me, I wouldn't do it anything like that. I'd do it much better. So hopefully when you get to do a play again, you find more in the character and can, explore more things.
Although actors complain about having to do many takes, but that's all at the same time. You would prefer to do those takes over the course of a couple of months?
Yeah, I'd like to be in Boyhood and get to do a performance over about 15 years. That would be ideal.
So that was, 12 years.
Yeah.
David, you said that you love rehearsals. How much was necessary when the play moved from the West End to the Golden Theatre?
Well, it was a sort of thoughtful period. It's a luxury, as Kerry says. You know, you've been doing it, and these two, and indeed Matthew Beard, we should add, who plays the son at the beginning and end of the play, magnificently.
He bookends.
Yeah, he bookends the play. That's exactly it. But the three of them, as far as I was concerned, at the Wyndham's, were playing this play as well as it can be played. It was just absolutely tip-top. But it is nice to step back and just have 10 days to think again and see, and then to guide it through the previews. Stephen Daldry's been here. He's been working on it and just fine-tuning it. And that is a great luxury of transfer. It's just richer and deeper than it's ever been, I think.
There was a time when union rules wouldn't have allowed you to bring the complete British cast.
Yeah, things have eased up a lot, mainly, I think, because there are so many American musicals playing in London and there's much easier exchange, and I don't hear that stuff. There aren't those dreaded meetings that there used to be at 9 o'clock in the morning with donuts and a terrifying man from Equity who
donuts?
Was...
Donuts? That sounds great. Yeah. Why are we having those?
There used to be a whole lot of manoeuvre about, oh, you can't do this, or I'll swap you a Sondheim for a straight play and all that. I don't know if that still goes on.
Do you like Kira?
Do I like her?
Do you connect to her?
Yeah.
As a person?
Yeah, I do. She reminds me a lot of one of my very close friends. So I like people who are passionate about things. I like people who have very strong beliefs. I think I'm drawn to people who are sort of, people like her who are very active and very passionate and get things done and, you know, move things.
Well, these are both people with strong beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of what makes the play so effective. Even though we may root for one more than the other, they both have their, they make some good points at different times.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I think the audience, they kind of swing between the two characters as the evening goes on. It's a deeply sophisticated play, and therefore everyone, they both talk rashly on occasion, and they both talk, with some wisdom and experience.
There's a crucial scene when Tom suddenly shows up where, Carrie, you're making spaghetti bolognese on stage, mm-hmm. and the smells drift into the audience. It smells really good. Does it drive you crazy with hunger?
I have been getting a bit hungry, yeah. It hasn't in the past, because I think that's another added advantage of doing it again is that I'm really good at the cooking now. You know, I've done, how many shows have we done?
Yeah, gazillions.
And yeah. But you also have to be delivering your lines while you're paying attention to make sure the food doesn't burn.
It's great fun. I mean, that was sort of the first 3 weeks of the rehearsals in London the first time around, was just learning how to cook, really. I didn't really think about anything else.
I think the only bad review we received in London was from the food critic of the Evening Standard, who described Carey's spaghetti bolognese as approximate, which was a word which we found deeply offensive, since we'd actually had an Italian cookery expert to teach us how to make spaghetti bolognese in the Italian way.
And I was following the recipe to the letter.
Well, Bill, you get a big laugh when you start to question Kira about how she's making the bolognese. You say, well, are you? And
are you going to put the chili in first?
Yes, yeah. Which is a good question to ask, and somebody who is a restaurateur would obviously think along those lines. But sure. I have heard that you don't even have an oven in your London home.
Well, you've been asking around, haven't you? It's true.
You're just playing a character who knows something about food here.
Yeah, you know, I had to do some research in that area. But no, personally, no, I don't own an oven. When I was moving into my flat, I live alone, and I was old enough to make decisions and not to pretend that I was ever going to cook. It's never going to happen. And I'm surrounded.
So it's all takeout?
It's decadence. It's all no takeout. I don't like takeout because that involves mess.
Uh-huh.
So I like to go. I walk out with a book under my arm, and I walk to a series of restaurants.
How long did you have to rehearse this before you got that cooking down?
Oh, I mean, I came straight off a job. I came in knowing none of the lines and having just had a cooking lesson. So it really did take about 3 weeks for me to get the cooking down, and about a month before I knew all the lines.
There's a kind of a choreography required as well in that tiny kitchen space.
Yeah, that's very much Stephen's choreography of how to, because it's all to do with the sound and to do with, you know, not bashing pasta over Bill's dialogue, you know, clanking things around. So it was all carefully choreographed by Stephen.
There's something in a naturalistic play, and I'd never written a naturalistic play before, but there's something in a naturalistic play which attracts obsession in the audience, and they become absolutely obsessed with the spaghetti. The Observer was so obsessed with the play that they actually put someone on a bus from Kensal Rise to East Ham, because in the play, her character works on one side of London and lives in the other. And the Observer devoted a whole page to whether this journey was possible.
I didn't know
whether you could actually whether you could actually do it in the time she says you do it, who you would meet on the bus if you did it. And It's very odd when you're a writer when people seem to think you've written something that is completely 100% real.
Yeah.
And it's been road tested like that by journalists. It's very strange.
And people have a reaction to that line about the cat being baked in the oven, as if it's a real cat. They're horrified that there might be this cat that was baked in an oven.
It has happened to friends of mine that this was in the 1970s when thieves visited your home in South London. The last thing they did as they left was put your cat in the oven and turn the oven on. They did do it.
That's kind of a power play?
Yeah. And you would come home and there would be this appalling stench. And you knew, and that was them leaving their mark to say, we can do anything in your house that we want to, just to scare the life out of you.
Did you know that from the start that you were going to have real cooking done in this?
Yeah, it seemed important. I'd resisted writing plays in rooms all my life. I've always written epic plays. And this was the first play in a room. So I thought, if I'm going to write a naturalistic play, I'm going to go for it.
It's a wonderful way to show how easy the two are together. And when Tom cuts his finger while he's grating the cheese, it suddenly makes him quite vulnerable.
Well, that's good. That's exactly how. Well, it was a way of, it's sort of, I think, what the director calls, what does he call it? Reverse psychology. At certain points when things are, you know, it's to intersperse quite intense exchanges with something relatively mundane, but which in some way seems to underwrite them in a satisfying way. And also sometimes he will direct us to perhaps have attitudes at a particular moment which seem counter to that which is going on. He's a very brilliant man.
Stephen Daldry, we should say.
Yeah, Stephen Daldry, the director.
He's been a guest on this show.
Yeah. Oh, good.
My guests are Bill Nye, Carrie Mulligan, and David Hare. We are talking about the first American production of Skylight in a 13-week limited engagement.
The first one came the first time.
But it wasn't on Broadway.
Yes. Michael Gambon came to Broadway with Leah Williams and played
at... And I missed it.
...what used to be called the Royal Theatre.
And what is it now? Whatever. Anyway, this will be running through Sunday, June 21st at the John Golden Theater at 252 West 45th Street. For ticket information, you go to our show page at WNYC.org. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Carrie Mulligan, Bill Nye, and David Hare, who was knighted in 1998.
Yeah, a long time ago.
But you're not calling yourself Sir Dave or
Never
anything?
Never do, no.
But you have written 30 dramas so far, and how many television scripts?
Oh, goodness,
as well?
I can't count. I think that somebody counted that I'd written 23 films, either for television or for the cinema.
Since they all involve dialogue, how different is the process?
Oh, totally. 100% different. And indeed, it took me years to understand anything about film at all. I sort of groped around in the dark for many years, thinking that because I had some skill in the theatre that it was transferable. And it wasn't until I learned that it was completely different that I began to be able to write films that I like.
But did one inform come to inform the other?
No. I think of them as completely separate skills. And I was lucky enough to work with Louis Malle. And Louis Malle really taught me how to write film by the most excruciating possible method, which was to sit me down every morning at 9 o'clock to tell the story of the film. And he constantly questioned me. And after 10 days, I could tell him the story of the film in a way which he no longer questioned.
Although Louis Malle was brilliant at taking theatrical productions like Uncle Vanya and making them into films.
Yeah. I mean, he was the only one who could ever do that.
So is one a break from the other?
Kind
of a palate cleanser?
It's exactly that. And because I have the skill, I exercise the skill in film, but I can't help thinking of the plays as what I did first.
Stephen Daldry is also directing another play on Broadway, The Audience with Helen Mirren. Did he have to run back and forth during rehearsals?
That's why our theatres are so close to each other on Broadway.
We're literally next door. There was an element of coming and going, toing and froing. I don't know how he does it.
Did he expect you to suddenly sound like Queen Elizabeth?
No. It's amazing how he manages to keep things completely separate. You don't. We had a bit of a schedule shuffle, but you never feel like he's dividing his attention. So it's pretty remarkable in that respect.
Critics often talk about the chemistry between actors, and there's a tremendous rapport between the two of you, despite the big gulf. There are many reasons for the gulf, among them that you haven't seen each other for 3 years, and I don't want to spoil the listeners' experience in telling them why that happened. I don't know if you mind talking about those things. But I wonder if the gulf was always there just because of their personalities and whether it just had grown bigger over time as they were apart.
I think what's remarkable about them is the fact that they do quite simply love one another, and their love is quite a rare form because it survived that gulf. It survived all kinds of things that might destroy, that would traditionally destroy any kind of love affair. And it survives their honesty with one another, which is quite remarkable. And it certainly survived their world view, their differing world view. One senses, even at the end of the play, that it survived whatever the weather and whatever may be in the future. I don't feel that it's been destroyed by the events that you see when you watch the play.
Mm. They love each other despite everything.
Yep.
Now, I asked earlier about whether the performances had changed at all in the transfer from the West End to Broadway. What about the intervening years? How is Bill's acting and interpretation of this part different almost 20 years later?
Well, I'll leave the room for a while.
It's improved, hasn't it?
I hope so.
No, I mean, what must
be. But it'll never be Michael Gambon.
No, exactly.
The great thing is that you just start again with things like this. You know, I'm lucky enough to be old enough that the whole series of my plays are now being revived. The Judas Kiss has just been revived in the West End with Rupert Everett. It obliterates the memory. And that is not disrespectful to the people who originally played it, not in the slightest. But inevitably, when you see a play brought to life in a great production, it doesn't bother you any more than it bothers you going to Hamlet. And the boring people who come out of Hamlet saying, well, it's not as good as Laurence Olivier, they're boring people and they're boring audiences to play to. And that, to me, this cast make the play live, and you really believe in the depth of their relationship, the layers of their relationship. And so I don't think about other productions at all.
I'm glad you brought up Hamlet, because I've thought a lot about that, how Shakespeare, I've had seen so many great Lears, so many great Hamlets,
yeah.
And what made them wonderful was the performance, the fact that that actor made that Lear into something different than that other actor who did a magnificent Lear did.
Precisely. I mean, the thing is that the theater as an art form always attracts what I call matchbox collectors. They're the people who just go and say, well, he's better than Derek Jacobi, but on the other hand, he's not as good as Mark Rylance. And they are the core audience, those people who go to compare and who talk about theater all the time. But Skylight's a play that plays to people who are not regular theatergoers. It plays to people who come into the theater and are interested in the things the play is about. And they're the people we love playing to.
Bill, you play the part with a lot of physicality. Why does Tom have so much nervous energy? Is that in the script, or is that something that you brought to it?
I don't think it's in the script, apart from the fact that, you know, she does say towards the end of the play, Carrie's character says that, I think you've patrolled this room 100 times or something. And she does, when she's, you know, at the very end of the play, she comments on his energy. The energy is great, but...
And restlessness.
And the restlessness. But I don't know that that's what that... I could pretend that that's me. That's what fuels my physicality, but it's not the case. It just seems to be what happens when I play this part, and I have no excuse, explanation further than beyond that, except that I think it will help you listen to me that's part of, and I think this could be complete tosh. I never know when I, because I'm asked this question. It's not the only time I've been, mentioned in these dispatches.
I didn't say disparaging.
No, I know you didn't, Leonard. I know, I absolutely know, and I'm trying to answer you honestly. So therefore, it may be true.
Because you're all over the stage and you're kicking chairs and you're doing all sorts of other things.
Yeah. I mean, there's something about the writing which suggests that he, apart from the fact that, that he is a kind of, that he has a certain degree of excess energy. And he's also on tenterhooks because this is a visit that he's taken 3 years to work up to. 3 years it's taken him to ring the doorbell, which is a long time to wait to ring a doorbell. And and one senses that the way that he has succeeded in other areas of life is by doing exactly what you see him do during the evening, which is to storm around and to project a great deal of energy onto any situation.
And Kira's way of dealing with him is to get calmer and calmer.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's like the power crazy. Play is, I'll drive you crazy by not responding in the way you expect me to.
Yeah, and I think that's just, who she, that's her way of exerting authority, is just keeping it cool.
Now, why did you use the Tom's son, Edward, as a bookend? Did you want to show us a younger version of Tom?
I can't talk about that, because if I talk about that, then I talk about what you'd call a spoiler.
Okay.
And I think that... But
you don't call it a spoiler in Britain?
Yeah. I mean, you used the word earlier, that's all. I'm picking up on the word that if I start talking about that, I start giving away the end of the play.
Right.
And I hope lots of your listeners are going to come innocent.
I mentioned David's writing for film and television. The two of you have done a fair amount of film and television. Carrie, an education inside Llewyn Davis, where I would not have known you were a Brit. Never Let Me Go, the upcoming Far From Madding Crowd. Bill, you have Love Actually, a Harry Potter, Pirates of the Caribbean, a couple of Best Exotic Marigold hotels to your credit. But I get the sense that both of you think of yourself as theater actors. Is that true?
I grew up in the theater, and there is no version of my life where I don't do plays. And I do... I nearly said something. That was PR. A bit of PR correct.
Oh, we wouldn't want you to
no,
do that.
No, sorry, Leonard. I forgot where I was for a moment. Let's stick with the truth. I think of myself as a film actor as well, but I did that. It was 10 years before I ever performed in front of a camera, for instance, in my youth, which was not an unusual progress when I was young.
But, of course, a lot more people will see you in a film, even a flop film, than they will in a hit play.
Sure. So at the moment I have a perfect situation where I try and balance the two to some degree.
And Carrie?
Yeah, I mean, I grew up wanting to be a musical theatre actress, which everyone thinks is hilarious because I can't dance and I can't really sing. But that was my dream, and that was what I was pretty sure I was going to do until I got some sort of self-awareness at around 15 and realised that wasn't going to happen. But it was theatre that I was drawn to, and what I imagined I would, that was my sort of idea of being an actress, was actually doing a play on Broadway was my kind of fantasy. And so film was not really something I ever really thought about. Television, I guess, I thought would be part of the dream in some way. But it was all sort of, I never really sort of planned on working in films. And I really like working on films. But when I sit in a cinema and watch a film, I don't think, oh, I can't wait to be back on a film set. But when I sit in a theatre, if it's a great play, I think, oh, I wish I was on stage. And I think that's just the difference, is I miss theatre in a way that I don't particularly miss films.
Well, in theatre, of course, you are interacting with the other people you're playing with. And in film, often you're shooting a scene in which you're supposedly interacting with somebody, and that person is in his room or wherever.
I haven't had that experience yet.
Rod Steiger still angry with Marlon Brando to the end of his life because Marlon Brando stepped out of the set during the famous taxicab scene, and he was just, after he had given him so much response when he delivered his lines. So
yeah. I've actually had the opposite experience. I have to say I've been so lucky to work with people who I think give as much when they're off camera as when they're on.
We have very little time left, but this is a limited run. You have other things already in the offing?
Bill?
Yes, I am going to make a film with the director who directed Carrie famously in An Education, Lona Scherfig. It's called Our Finest Hour and a Half. It's set against a backdrop of the making of propaganda.
We have 5 seconds, Carrie. What about you?
No holiday for me,
hooray.
I think.
Skylight is at the John Golden Theater until Sunday, June 21st. Thank you all so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/Leonard Lopate WNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.